This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware. So I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Hey everybody, Christian here with this bonus content for DLC, and I am super excited for this conversation. I am sitting here with Jord Tittle and Corey Schmitz to talk about their upcoming game, the upcoming game, C Smash VRS. But before we get into that, I would love it if you could both introduce yourselves, talk a little bit about who you are, what you do, and then maybe how that transitions into C Smash VRS. And Jord, I'll let you go first, if you wouldn't mind telling us who you are, what you do, and why you're excited about this game.
Hey, I'm Jörg Tittle, and I'm a writer and director and producer, and now also publisher, oh my god, of games and films. And well, I don't publish films, you can't publish them really, but I've directed films, and I'm producing a film coming out next year with John Malkovich in one of the leads called A Winter's Journey, which is a film we've been working on with PlayStation, actually, and with Media Molecule on to design and build the sets and stuff. So, and that my wife, Alex Helfricht, is written and is directing this beautiful painted animated film. And then I used to be a video game journalist a good 2.5 or so decades ago, and which means I'm very, very old. And so then back then I worked for the official Dreamcast magazine, for instance, and Next Gen, which was the now sadly no longer, it no longer exists, sort of sister magazine to Edge, which is the beautiful UK magazine Edge, which we actually just graced the cover of that with C Smash. For those listeners who sadly don't have access to this video feed, because you won't. Because we're actually naked while we're recording this. Corey is currently dancing in front of, it's very strange to look at, by the way, in front of our Edge cover. And then I make video games as well. And there's one game called The Last Worker, which is coming out on the 30th of this month on everything, pretty much, VR, consoles, and PC, a game that's been in development for a long time. And with that same incredible developer, Wolf and Wood, we have also been working on C Smash. And yeah, perhaps later we can talk about that sort of those old Dreamcast days and all sorts of other crazy roots that to this project that I just briefly alluded to.
No, yeah, yes. That's perfect. I mean, I am a fan of your work. I've seen some of your older work and trailers and concepts for some of this upcoming stuff. And then I think it was Corey's, maybe it was the first tweet. I'm not on social media much anymore, but I saw, I keep abreast of Corey's work, certainly, always. And then I saw this, and I saw the Edge cover. And yeah, my Dreamcast sense was tingling. I was so excited about this game, and I love what I've seen. Corey, some folks here at DLC may know you and your work already a little bit, but I'd love it if you could introduce yourself and perhaps a little bit about what drew you to this project and why you're naked in front of the Edge cover right now.
I'm fully clothed. Thank you.
By the way, yeah, Christian said he likes to keep abreast. That's what he was alluding to. There you go.
We're off the rails.
Yeah. Already, yeah. I'm Corey Schmitz. I'm a graphic designer, mostly working in the game industry, but I dabble in some other realms. I mostly work on logos and branding for games and studios. I did... bunch of stuff for PlayStation, and I made like the logo for Valorant, and I worked on the Oculus logo and Polygon and a lot of stuff. Control, Analog, Stray, but I also worked on the DLC podcast logo.
And all of the buttons on my bag that no one can see are all Corey logos over the years.
Yeah. But I've been at it for 12-ish years, just a solo freelance operation. And when Jorg hit me up about this project, I was like, wow, that's such a cool series to work on. It's one of those things that you would never think would come back, but then it just seems like a perfect fit. So I immediately said yes.
I'll zoom us out a little bit for folks who don't know. C Smash is, and if I get this wrong, please someone correct me, but the next entry in the Cosmic Smash saga series. I can't call it a series yet because there hasn't been two, but Cosmic Smash was a Naomi board arcade game made by Sega and then later ported to the Dreamcast in 2001. And if you don't know what Cosmic Smash is, dear listener, I am so sorry that you got to educate yourself on some Dreamcast hits. But it's a breakout-like, if you were trying to kind of extrapolate the genre of what Cosmic Smash was back in the day. And very much of the Dreamcast era. It was quirky. It had style. It had a feeling to it that I think went above and beyond any of its individual parts per se. And in my opinion, a lot of Dreamcast games were that. If I were to talk about Jet Set Radio and what that was, it's not one individual thing. It's the whole buffet that it brought to the senses that really elevated it. And I think Cosmic Smash was also one of those games. And now here we are 22 years later, getting another installment in this series. Like the next installment, and now bringing it to VR. This is the time that we can talk about that. And going back to 2001, and in my head, 2023 in VR oddly feels like 2001 a little bit. And it's playful, experimental, places for cool vibes and projects to exist. And I'm curious what that was like for you. I've read certainly some of the interviews you've already done, you know, working with Sega and stuff like that. But I'd love for the DLC folks to hear some of that good stuff as well.
Yeah. Hopefully we can get them some exclusive deal content. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth in the next few minutes, but it was interesting. Like the Naomi was interesting because that was an arcade board that was actually a Dreamcast with more RAM. And so it wasn't actually a port as much as it was actually just the same game. And it didn't require much RAM because there was, you know, graphically, it wasn't a super complex game. Although when you take a look at it now, it still looks fresh because it had style. It had incredible style. I remember seeing one screenshot of it in Famitsu, the Japanese magazine. And back then I was living in New York. And I'd written an interview actually with Yoshitaka Amano, who was at the time living in New York and working out of a studio there on Final Fantasy. But he was actually at the time working with Neil Gaiman on a project. And I got to interview him for Famitsu, which was incredible. And so I got to invite him to the studio. And when I finally got that issue, like 3 or 4 months later, and my nonsense had been translated into Japanese to a point where I could no longer read any of it, I'm sure they improved it greatly. And there were some pictures of Amano-san in there, and I flipped the page, and then on the next page or so, there was this incredible, like, reduced style game, and it said Cosmic Smash, and I saw the word Naomi in there, and I saw DC. It's like, wow, and I knew that the Dreamcast was about to be discontinued because I was working for the official Dreamcast magazine, so all that was a very sad time. So it was almost like this, like, phoenix rising from the ashes. It was this sort of iconic thing that said, like, yeah, sure, maybe this thing is dying, but I'm gonna leave a mark, and I'm going to make sure that you remember me. And when eventually that iconic cover came out, which was this, like, DVD case, which was unusual for the Dreamcast, especially in Japan, and it had this orange disc that was shining through this semi-transparent sleeve. It was so gorgeous. It's like, wow, these people really have put so much thought and care into this, you know, knowing that it probably will reach a very, very small audience. And so I fell in love. I was just like, this is courageous. It's beautiful. It's essential. And I knew that it would outlast all the other sort of, you know, PS2 and other sort of like super textured, quote unquote, realistic looking games that were coming out at the time. And sure enough, to this day, this is a game that has inspired lots of people, including perhaps even Corey, to do what we do and what we sort of strive to achieve. Corey?
Oh, yeah, it's true. I was going to say, I mean, this is like one of those games that kind of stands with like, you know, like Wind Waker or Rez or Killer 7 that just looks so good after all these years because they're going for something different instead of the run-of-the-mill kind of realistic look. I totally agree. And yeah, the cover is just like legendary, like super inspirational, like great use of space and having that disc shine through is just really unique. Definitely like harkens back to that really creative era. There's a lot of stuff on like PS1 at that same time too, like Parappa and some, you know, games that cost like $20, which I thought was always cool. Like you could get like little creative experiences on the, you know, for a good budget. And I think it's a very memorable game that I do think inspired a lot of people, even though most people haven't heard of it.
Yeah. Well, the Dreamcast also was this incredible place for, I think it really invented modern day indies like Sega did with the Dreamcast and the way they were going about their business, which maybe didn't work out in the short term, but I think in the long term they've won because that spirit has continued to resonate. And as far as I'm concerned, the games that are made in that spirit are the only one that have meaning to me today as well. It's that they encouraged all the developers, and they were sort of semi-independent from Sega. They're owned by Sega, but they had total autonomy, whether it was Tetsuya Mizuguchi's studio, which was at the time called United Game Artists, or Sega Rosso, which was founded by his director on Sega Rally, because Tetsuya had produced Sega Rally. And the director on Sega Rally is a guy who actually was one of the art directors on the original Ridge Racer before making some other cool shit. And he then founded the studio Sega Rosso and was the exec producer on Cosmic Smash. And he's a friend of ours and, you know, he's been incredibly supportive throughout this process, which is stunning. But Sega said to these people, just make the game you want to make. Like, that was the rule. And that explains why those games are what they are and that why they still resonate to this day, even though perhaps they might not have had the sort of market sort of impact at the time. You know, the reason that we're still wanting to bring back that feeling or try and take it further and try and actually do, you know, make them a success so many years after is kind of gorgeous, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff, at least for me, in that Dreamcast era, and maybe even just that early aughts of gaming that feels like, you know, seeing a visual artist at the gallery you just happened to pop into, or seeing a band at CBGB before it closed, or, you know, at Deep Ellum or something. And it's like this small event, and you're sitting and you look around and you're like, this is happening right now. And they might not ever become mainstream. It might not ever blow up the way you think they will. But it resonates with you in such a personal way that while it's never the hundred million seller, it has inspired so many artists from that have then become those 100 million sellers. And I think we're seeing a lot of that indie spirit in VR now as well. And I think there's a testament to what VR brings to the table and that so many of these early aught games are coming back and I think are perhaps best experienced in VR. Rez was a fantastic game when it came out in VR. I think it's only been made better. Also similar aesthetic a little bit to Cosmic Smash in terms of the humanoid shape and kind of how it's hanging in space at times. Humanity, a new game coming out as well that doesn't require VR, but seems to elevate it and seems to play in this indie spirit. And I'm going to use the word vibe too many times, but it there's a vibe or an essence to it that is more than just looking at it on a flat screen. And I'm curious, Jörg, I'll set this up to you, what bringing Cosmic Smash to VR, you know, what the biggest fear was in terms of taking this iconic game. Again, maybe not the 100 million seller, oh, they're remaking Resident Evil 4 type pressure, but certainly pressure of I'm going to make a game, a new game out of this iconic, timeless thing, and I'm going to do it in a medium that didn't exist back then. And kind of, was that scary, exciting? What those feelings were like?
Well, I fear is not really a thing that drives me much, but I think there were two concerns that were most important to me. I wanted to make sure that I get the blessing of the original creators. So even though there are some people working in a licensing department on Sega, and God knows it took me a couple of years to convince them, like what I wanted to make sure of is that, you know, that Sasaki-san, you know, who I just mentioned, Sega also founder, at least would give me his blessing and to do this, and that he would side with, you know, what I wanted to do with it. But also, one can't make a game alone, not a game like this. Also, I have no absolute skills, so, you know, that's why I'm a director. But Corey was actually the first person I approached, because I felt that this game is about graphic design. To me, it felt like it's graphic design made physical. And so I had to, if a game that to me felt like to this day is a design icon, I had to go to the one guy that understands the idea of making iconic images and iconic brands and iconic design a leading light in games. And because, I mean, for instance, you can go on a storefront on one of those endless thumbnail menus on the, you know, PlayStation Store or Steam or whatever, and most games look exactly alike now. I mean, it's all sort of like purplish color scheme and sort of like neon lights and sort of cyberpunk whatever. It is so it's the logo has suddenly become the most essential element that will distinguish games that are all resembling each other. The logo is the one that makes them stand apart. And Corey is the person that is actually responsible for the most iconic games on storefronts, in digital storefronts and beyond. And at the same time, Corey also understands physical media and, you know, for instance, the work that he's done with Tetsuya, actually, and with, you know, on the Resri issues and things like that, and books and vinyls and things is gorgeous. And VR is a physical medium, you know. Actually, to me, games are a physical medium. They started out as a physical and a social medium. That's what the arcades were. You know, we've almost removed ourselves from that because of these big tech. So I want us to be like sort of, you know, sitting at home and like stuck and then second screening and, you know, stealing our data or whatever they want to do. But so what I love about VR is that it's a return to the feeling that Sega and others were giving us at the very beginning of our gaming journey with Outrun, for instance. When I sat down as an 8-year-old in an Outrun cabinet in 1986 in Brussels at a fun fair, you know, my feet could barely reach the pedals. But that was a virtual reality experience. You know, I was sitting inside the headset, right? You know, it was moving me about. It was magical. And so it was, so even back in 2001, when I played Cosmic Smash for the first time, I wanted it to be a VR game, because Sega to me always was a VR company. Virtua Racing VR was actually going to be a VR game for the Genesis, because they were going to release a Sega VR headset back in 1993, which they announced at CES, and they're going to sell it for $200. And then some kid probably vomited in front of Tom Kalinske or something, and they're afraid of lawsuit, and then they canceled the whole thing. But so it was my dream for two decades to bring this to VR, because I wanted to be inside this world.
York, did you ever see the prototype that Tetsuya had, or I think he had it with the two Genesis or the two Game Gear screens as like for the headset? Was that him?
Yes,
I think it was.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he was always but Sasaki-san had made, you know, he made a game with Michael Jackson, right? Where you'd get into this like pod thing with this surround screen and surround sound, and Michael would be like, go left, go right, you know, and then you'd be like, and you fucking fly around. And it was incredible. It was this super immersive experience. Those guys were they understood synesthesia. That's what they were going for from the beginning. Like these two dudes, you know, they.
We can full circle it with, you know, the Scream music video kind of has a cosmic smash vibe at the end of it. And it gets us right back to where we started here.
Okay, so this is the DLC exclusive. This is it. We're coming to it. Because Kenji Sasaki has confirmed to me that the Scream video with Janet and Michael Jackson was the main inspiration for Cosmic Smash.
There you go. Okay. I mean, it's kind of uncanny, you know, when you look at it in retrospect.
It was the most expensive music video ever made at the time.
I remember that, yeah. The MTV Countdown had that as like number one.
It's stunning. So it has the same sort of white really produced cool, yeah. backgrounds. It has the sort of Japanese, but also it also took a lot from Sega, right? At the same time.
Like
it was super inspired by, so it was this cultural exchange. And we now know that Michael Jackson had written music for Sonic 3, which you know, Yuji Naka, bless him, had confirmed a couple months ago in a tweet. It's interesting that time. Anyway, yeah, we're going off a tangent there, but
no, that's a great tangent. And I think the Scream music video, much like Jamiroquai's video, is a video that has remained timeless, where it was had a future sensibility and setting at the time, but done in a way that seems clean and timeless, or 2001 A Space Odyssey 2 for a film that was like a future setting, but that was built in such a functional way that it is still pleasing today. Corey, I'm curious what it was like for you to work in, you know, in VR for this game and to build the look ideas, kind of what that approach was like after, you know, you got the call and ready to go. Was there, I know exactly what this is going to be. I love design process. I love hearing about it. So anything about that you're willing to share or can share? Did you just wake up in a cold sweat 1:30 in the morning and be like, I got it. You know, give me a pen. Here we go.
No, it was just exciting. Cause yeah, it's just such an evocative game to work on. And there's a kind of a lot to pull from and a lot of cool inspirations like around the periphery of it, but I mean, I think the first thing I started with was like working on the logo, because it was just kind of immediate, and I was just like, I think I probably started working on in Illustrator while I was like talking to Jörg like for the first time, because it's just so obvious, like, okay, we're just gonna kind of evolve it. And you said it's like, you said vibes a lot, like this is like a vibes game for sure. So I was just kind of trying to just capture that tone. Like there's nothing specific, there's no like specific reason to a lot of the stuff. It's just kind of getting the feel right. So I kind of took that approach with the logo, like going from, you know, that classic C that they had, which had two parts to it, and just adding a third part. It's pretty simple, just kind of doing that, and then just kind of, you know, evolving the look and streamlining it a bit and just making it a bit more like geometrically consistent. And then coming up with the logo type, which is like the, you know, the text by the logo, and just honing that in. That took a while, just getting the right feel for that. And then we brought in my friend Dan, aka Archetype, who's super amazing designer. He's very, very technically minded, very precise, works with like a lot of, you know, negative space and just kind of this really clean look. We thought he'd be perfect. So he helped out a lot on the, throughout the whole process, but like, especially on like our pitch deck, which like in retrospect, like the pitch deck looks like a, you know, better than a lot of like final games, like instruction booklet or something like whatever the equivalent is. Like it looks really cool.
One day we'll release that pitch deck for people to see, because it was, I mean, and book, because there's going to be a book that we're going to release with, this is another exclusive, I think. we're going to release a book with the fine folks at Lost and Cult later this year. It's going to be an art book. And they're the publisher also behind the beautiful Lock-On magazine, quarterly, for which Corey actually designed the logo.
So, yeah.
But yeah, it's working. It was amazing because we were this team of three at the beginning, Corey, Archetype, Dan, and myself, devising this pitch deck, like setting the sort of, you know, look Bible or whatever for the game, but also creating with that a sort of an argument for Sega to hopefully, you know, grant us the rights to do this. And then Kenji, gave us his blessing, allowed us to use his name in there. And Kenny Shi, the wonderful musician and DJ, who had lent one of his tracks, one of the amazing dynamic tracks to Rez, also joined us. And then at first very reluctant Ryan Bousfield, creative director at Wolf and Wood, because we had already been working on The Last Worker. We were like a year into development at the time. It's been a couple since. It's like, yeah, sure, whatever. If it happens, I might do it with you. Yeah, just talk.
Yeah, I don't know if you know, but Jorg was like working on like two other games at the same time, and movies, and just like a million things. So
first game submitted to VR festivals that didn't accept game. Oh yeah, I'm glad you're letting. Because yes, I should have set this up better. Pioneering new spaces and reinventing old spaces and working in, I love this beautiful blend of like VR and technology and cinema and design and everything that's coming together. Yeah. So you and the developers seem to have their hands full. And I like the idea of this beautiful pitch deck coming to be and being like, can you make your hands bigger, please, dear friends? Cause we have more work to do.
I don't know. I just felt like the world was coming to an end, or perhaps it always has been. But I mean, it certainly seems to be spinning in all sorts of crazy directions. And I felt that since life being short, I felt like I had to spin multiple plates in order to sort of leave a mark and leave something positive behind and give some enjoyment to people. Because The Last Worker is a beautiful game. I'm enormously proud of it. And it's funny, but it's also intense. It's intensely funny. It's also intensely dark. And it's a narrative driven game. And there's a lot of opinions in there. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of satire in there. It's quite a punk game, and on an epic scale, made by just a team of 10, you know, ultimately, including freelancers, you know. So it's been really hard to make. And then so C-Smash was also not just an additional thing, but also a palate cleanser in a way. It felt clean. It felt like something where we can strip away all narrative and all dialogue. And it's like tens of thousands of lines of dialogue inside in The Last Worker, recorded by this enormous cast and blah, blah, blah. But here, like the idea of like being able to just make everything about just feeling experience, like feeling good inside of it, like making the player just, you know, relax from all of this noise out there, just felt essential
it's a very
to me.
Clean aesthetic, like there's no textures or I mean there might be but there's no effects, or it's just very clean and slick. And how would you describe it, Jorg? Just like.
Yeah, I think it's
there's like no extra there's no extra elements. There's nothing.
We decided we were super design nerds about it. So we, for instance, went to maybe an obvious design reference, but one of the essential ones, which is Dieter Rams, and one of the sentences we actually put him in the pitch deck as well. We put "less but better" by Dieter Rams. This wonderful phrase, yeah, less but better. It is sort of one of the tenements of design for him. And it's true. Like if you, and also my father, you know, who's no longer with us, but he would always tell me, like, if the smartest person uses the simplest words, because they don't have to impress you with their incredible vocabulary or by overcomplicating things. And also the smartest person gets to distill complex ideas into simple thoughts. And if we can do that with a game, it will feel so unlike everything else out there, which has become so filled with, you know, features and effects and freaking whatever, ray tracing, whatever. I just don't want to look at realism in games because I see it outside and it's kind of sucks right now. It's a bummer. You know, reality is a bummer at the moment.
Yeah. Bouncing off of the Dieter Rams stuff, like that was something else that was cool was, when we were working on like the UI, for instance, Archetype, he did most of like the heavy lifting on the UI, but I think we all kind of directed it in some sense and we really wanted to get that right. That was like kind of the main thing that the designers worked on was like the menus and how that looks and how it feels. And just the, like, we, I think, Jorg mentioned Dieter Rams, and I think, Archetype was really influenced by the 72 Olympic program by Otto Eicher. And I was kind of thinking more about like that kind of Y2K era aesthetic. Well, a bit more like, there's like another aesthetic called like Gen X Soft Club that I really like. That's it's kind of, it's similar. It's kind of stripped back and really clean, and it uses like the Swiss fonts and has like cool photography and like, you know, lots of white negative space, and they have like a lot of rounded corners and a lot of like dot icons, and I think all three of those aesthetics kind of melded together in like a really unique, cool way that totally honors the original game, but it looks, you know, it looks of the same vibe, going back to vibe again.
A big challenge,
total evolution. Yeah.
A big challenge was to then take this, because these are all fundamentally two-dimensional design schools. I mean, even Dieter Rams' work, like, ultimately is meant to be looked at frontally. I mean, in a way. I mean, it's like they're just such beautiful panels, and they feel 2D to me. But I've also realized they are 3D objects. And so to capture that idea in a game to physicalize graphic design means, because I mean, Corey just said we have no effects. We actually have effects in the game, but they don't feel like effects. They feel like graphic design that's like in motion. So for instance, when the ball is moving slowly, it leaves a shadow of balls behind it, which are changing in a gradient style with the colors sort of changing in intensity. And there's a very, the color palette is a piece of art in our game, because there's only a very few colors that we actually get to use in the game. And so everything has to work within that. But so the ball, but if it moves fast, then it leaves a streak behind. The streak is actually just a line in space, but we train the player to gradually look at it as if it was a representation of speed, which is counterintuitive in a way, because a line shouldn't feel fast, but it does here. And it's amazing to be in that. And then also, like, if a ball hits a wall, it will leave a dot ripple effect, which will, so instead of like particles flying ever or whatever, you see these just dots, because you realize that there's dots embedded in everything, every single panel, every surface in the game. Has this?
There's a lot of dots in this game.
Dot DNA, but it feels. So I'm really sorry to tryptophobes out there. But actually, yeah. I have tested it on a trip. I don't know for the listeners who don't know what a tryptophobe is someone who has a fear of dots and holes. I don't know. Did you know that exists, Christian?
This is new. Yeah,
it's more about the holes, right?
It's more about the holes, I think. Yes, and I've tested it on a friend of mine who is, and I was very scared that she would freak out, and she was fine. So I can't guarantee that if you happen to be a tryptophobia listener, you might not freak out in this dot DNA game, but I think you'll be fine.
Until the final
boss battle.
The idea of a flow state, not in terms of like playing Rez or Tetris Effect or something like that, but in terms of actual user experience flow of getting into a game or an experience. And a lot of times in flat games, those can be wonderful, delightful experiences, but they can also be held up with required corporate logos or licenses or something like that. But then also just not spending time making that a focus of the experience. Oh, you're going to see this, but we want you to live in this world and go on this adventure with this character, or, you know, do this platforming. And I think in VR, again, for me, that user experience flow becomes even more important, because I am living in a space where I've had some wonderful VR games. Gran Turismo 7, I love in VR. I absolutely adore it, but it certainly bounces you in and out. You know, the menus aren't a place that you live in. They are not, they're aesthetically pleasing on a flat screen, and I love the music and the design behind them, but that VR experience is a little less than as you kind of bounce in and out of races. Whereas I think some of the best VR games are games that you know, the design you don't see, where you don't even realize you're interacting with design because it is part of the experience of playing the game. And a menu doesn't feel like a menu. It feels like a delicious first course, to not sound pretentious, but this idea that everything fulfills a purpose and a goal. And as people are listening to this, the demo is out for C Smash, so folks can experience that version of the game. But from what I've seen of the game, and certainly what has existed of Cosmic Smash, is something that I think takes that design philosophy from the very beginning through the end of the game, where the player's time is meant to be an experience. And I'm curious if there were what extra thought perhaps was put into that. Corey, I'll start with you, for a VR designed game versus if someone's going to be interacting with it on a flat screen, and not needing to create a world that's both, where some games, I'll use Humanity again as an example, runs on a flat screen, great, but also is catering to a VR audience. With C Smash VRS, you're catering just to that VR audience. And I'm wondering if that was freeing, perhaps, in terms of how you engaged in that design.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, Humanity in VR is like a whole different thing, in my opinion. Like, it's so just a transcendent, like, change from the flat. I mean, the flat one looks gorgeous, but man, when you see it in VR, that's like special. Like, it's crazy. But I mean, it's cool. I mean, it's as far as like UI, it's interesting because you're not working with like physical boundaries, like a screen as much, but we're just working with like field of view. And it was actually cool making like the menus, for instance, because you forget that you're like also designing not only in that space, that large physical space, but you also have like the 3D element. So like we have a menu system that is layered, like in kind of a parallax way, where there's like, I can't remember exactly how many layers, but like the importance of each panel is closer to the viewer. So, but it's only subtle. It's like, you know, just a bit of depth in between them. So that's the kind of stuff that we had in mind when we were designing it. It's just like, how can we use this to kind of elevate the experience a bit?
It's subtle. I think subtle is the key word here as well, is because, you know, I remember watching Mad Max Fury Road in 3D, and that was not how it was not filmed with 3D cameras. They added the 3D later, and there's a moment at which the steering wheel flies towards you. The rest of the film had not a single meaningful 3D moment, but also this one was completely meaningless, because is it important for me to look at this particular steering wheel up close? Like, why do I need to see this? So the idea of actually using a medium and its magic in an essential way is important, I find. And so that's been the important thing. Whenever we felt that something is gimmicky, we would drop it. So there was all this conversation. I mean, we have like, you know, this like endless Discord stream, you know, on, you know, we're doing with Wolf and Wood, with Corey, with Archetype, with art director Rob Davis as well, where we've just been like, you know, nah, that just feels like a gimmick. Nah, that's too much. Here you're just showing off. And so we've been doing a lot of this because we want it to be delightful, but we also don't want it to feel like a gimmick. And we didn't want anything to be loud. We wanted everything to be beautiful and just right. Because
yeah, nothing's in your face at all.
Everything feels relaxing. Even when it's intense, it's intensely relaxing. Even when you're getting super physical and super sweaty and I think we've taken the work out of the workout, you know, with this game. But we also put delightful things in it. Like, we take an advantage of the medium. For instance, you know, the cosmic bus was this sort of iconic thing in the original game, I mean, kind of a nonsensical thing, because you're on a bus and then you're playing squash between stations or whatever, or cosmic smash
in space.
So we have this shuttle that is also the menu system. And I loved Corey's logo so much that I transformed it into a space station. So the space station is shaped, if you see, look at the teaser site, you might see that the space station is actually Corey's logo, and you're inside of those C rings. And so we've created a a system, a transport system within the space station that eventually shoots you out into space for more distant adventures. But the shuttle inside the space station is also almost like a theme park ride, because between every stop and i.e. every menu, sub-menu, you get to see a different corner of the space station. And so I look forward to listeners in the full game, because in the demo you get to only see one of the stations, in the full game experiencing, you know, the extent of thought that we've all put into sort of building, giving it a life of its own, and also allowing characters that only appeared in the end credits in the original game, the cosmonauts, as we call them, they have, you know, we've given them a whole life, a whole sort of a whole logic to them as well. Without being narratively driven, I think people will be able to interpret their own world building into it, which has been a lot of fun as well.
The demo is out now as people are listening to this, available on PlayStation VR 2. If you don't have a PlayStation VR 2, you can order one directly from Sony in the United States. It's still the only way that you can get one. Other territories, you can get it from retailers. If you've listened to the main show, you certainly hear Jeff and I praise our experience with PSVR 2. It is my favorite headset, I think, because I thought the Quest would be it, because I could play it anywhere. But I think because I could play it anywhere, I almost played it nowhere. I didn't set the space up for it. And the PSVR 2, the OLED screens, the hood, so to speak, there's a lot less light leak. The Sense controllers are fantastic. So C-Smash VRS looks fantastic. I'm going to ask the question because I have you both here, but I think I know the answer. Release date, question mark?
As the new trailer that we've just released on the 23rd of March has revealed, the full game will come out on the 23rd of June. So, yes, so 23rd of June, 2023, essentially 23 years after the original game was released on Naomi. Yeah, that's why the 23 number has been so prevalent in all of our design as well, and all of our different story beats in our marketing, you know, rendered in the beautiful font that Corey and Archetype have so beautifully honed and perfected and polished. I hope that you'll love the demo and the full game even more, because there's so much that we are not showing yet.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for chatting with me. The demo out now. It launched on the 23rd of this month, full game, June 23rd, 2023. It is C-Smash VRS. I'm so excited to play it. Congratulations on everything that you've put out into the world thus far. And I'm so excited for C-Smash to continue to inspire future artists to make cool stuff. Thanks so much.
Christian, thank you so much for having us.